Welcome to Video Store. My name is Sam Mulberry. Today we are talking about the 1946 film A Matter of Life and Death. So let's step into Barrett Fisher's Video Store. Barrett, how you doing?
Doing great.
Barrett, this is our first Powell and Pressburger film, also known as The Archers. Do you know why they're called The Archers?
Nope.
Okay.
I actually did a little bit of research on it, and at least the all-knowing Wikipedia does not reveal why. It just says they chose that name for the company, so I have not been able to figure it out.
It's great branding, and it's a great image at the beginning of the film with the which I was first introduced to through Meet Earl and the Dying Girl. They do a parody of that Archer's opening. I remember seeing that and thinking, huh, I don't know what that is. And then I saw it on this one. I was like, now I know what they're referencing there. What is your history with this film? When did you first encounter this?
Yeah, just a good question. I'm trying to remember. I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, I can't remember if it was on the Criterion Channel at that point, and that's why I caught up with it. But it was a while ago. And I had seen some earlier. Before that, I had seen A Canterbury Tale. And many years ago, The Red Shoes and Black Narcissus. So I'd sort of seen a few over the years. But yeah, this one, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago.
So it was relatively recent
that you
encountered it. What do you remember your first impressions upon seeing it? Was it something before you watched that you were pretty aware of, or?
Yeah, no, I didn't know much about it. I knew the premise, and of course, you know, I was struck, as everybody was, immediately by the counterintuitive depiction of heaven or the afterlife or whatever it is versus, you know, the earth. I was kind of surprised. The tone was interesting. I wasn't quite expecting that. It's got it does have an interesting tone. And the other thing that was interesting for me is I don't think I'd ever seen a David Niven performance before. I mean, I certainly knew who David Niven was, but I don't think I had ever seen him in a role like that before. And I was just really impressed by his performance.
You know, it's funny you say that. I had the same experience where I know I've seen him in things, or I know. To your point, I know who he is. Like, that was the one name that I knew. But I didn't think of him as this character. Whatever I have in my head as an image of David Niven, it wasn't this character. And I really liked him. He was charming and dashing in the best kinds of ways, I think, in this movie. So can you tell me a little bit about Powell and Pressburger? So clearly you've seen more of their films than I have, because this is the only one that I've seen. Do you have a sense of like what are the hallmarks of a Powell and Pressburger film?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. I haven't seen, I don't think they did maybe 17, 20 films together. So my sense of a Powell and Pressburger film has a lot to do with what they were doing in the 40s and early 50s. And one element, well, it's interesting you should ask that, because Powell actually articulated a kind of manifesto. He wrote a letter in 1942 to Wendy Hiller to ask her to appear in The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp. And so what he says in the manifesto kind of speaks to the philosophy behind the Powell Pressburger films. And one which I think is particularly important for this film is he says, no artist believes in escapism. And we secretly believe that no audience does. We have proved that at any rate they will pay to see the truth for other reasons than her nakedness. He also talks about his films, and this may not be something you necessarily see when you watch the film, but behind the scenes, films are highly collaborative, beginning with Powell and Pressburger themselves. They remind me probably most closely of the Coen brothers, where it's really hard to separate out. I mean, Powell did the bulk of the directing, Pressburger does the bulk of the writing, but they definitely were always on set at the same time. They really worked closely together. So I think their films come out of a very collaborative kind of communal undertaking. They have some recurring actors like Roger Livesay, who plays the doctor, and Marius Goring, who plays Conductor 71. But I do think, to go back to that idea of truth, I think that even though some of their films are set kind of in exotic places or even historical settings, they always are interested in how those films, what truths they shed on kind of contemporary world. And that's clearest in this film. Obviously, it's so much about World War II and its aftermaths. The other thing I would say, which is another reason I love this film, is their cinematographer, Jack Cardiff, was a master of Technicolor technique. And so one of the things you get with a lot of their distinctive films after the war is this glorious Technicolor. So I think about this film, I think about Black Narcissus, I think about The Red Shoes, Tales of Hoffman. These are gorgeously filmed Technicolor. So they're also beautiful films to look at for that reason.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that was actually one of the things that struck me the most, is I was aware that this is a Technicolor film. And, you know, within the first probably 10 years of Technicolor as a in existence. And I was thinking to myself, if you ask me to say what Technicolor was, I mean, I know it's a process and things like this. Like, I can't quite describe it, but I kept looking at the screen and saying, this might be what it is at its best. Like, this movie, like, every scene that's in color, it looks like a painting. Like, mm-hmm. It actually, and I don't just mean it's, you know, well composed and this type of thing, but like, it actually doesn't look like the type of things that I see on screen now. Like, it feels like every frame kind of is an oil painting and a watercolor painting at the same time. Like, I can't describe it exactly, but I'm blown away by how many times you could pull a still from this and just say, that is a gorgeous image that does not feel purely like photography.
It's such, I mean, sometimes at its worst, Technicolor seems kind of overdone. Mm-hmm. But there's a quality of saturation and kind of vividness to it that I think is really, I love the comparison to an oil painting, Sam. I think in many ways it has that quality. It has the quality of an oil paint. The reds in particular, but I think that some Technicolor can look garish. Mm-hmm. And I think that doesn't. This to me, as I said, it looks saturated more than anything else.
Yeah, I kept looking at the screen, also thinking like, man, the darks look really good in this. Because there is they do so much with dark and shadow, especially in the early scenes mm-hmm. of the early color scenes of this film. Is pretty extraordinary. I mean, another thing that jumped out to me with this, even before starting watching it, is that this is a 1946 film. I was doing a little research. 1946 is tied for the second most watched on this podcast year for movies. Oh. I think this is our fifth 1946 film. And, you know, when you think 1946, you think, okay, well, this is coming out of the war. This is a movie that definitely deals with the war. Definitely. And we can talk about some of the origins of why this movie exists. Mm-hmm. It's definitely wrestling with both the war and what does the world look like after the war, which made me think a lot about two other 1946 movies we watched, William Wyler's Best Years of Our Lives, and It's a Wonderful Life by Frank Capra. Like, I feel like this is in conversation with all of these people kind of dealing with either what are the effects of the war on people or what do we do now?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really fascinating conversation to wrestle with cinematically.
I think there's a really interesting parallel to The Best Years of Our Lives, because Best Years of Our Lives is really about, okay, the war is over, what happens to the people who fought in the war? And this film is more about the war is over, what happens to the relationship between America and Britain. You know, 46 is Churchill's speech about the special relationship. The film, you know, one critic actually wants to make the film almost an allegory. And to a certain degree, I suppose you could say it is kind of allegorical. But with all good allegories, it works very well at the concrete level. So it begins right with an American and a Brit. And then they end up kind of they're writ large in terms of the relationship between the two countries.
I mean, it also, you know, is wrestling with, I mean, they wouldn't have had the terminology of PTSD, but as you're thinking about Peter and definitely Best Years of Our Lives is the Dana Andrews character. Like, that's one of the things that he's sort of wrestling with, like what are the effects of things that have happened to us either mentally, psychologically, or physically. And then what does that mean going forward? It definitely deals with the question in a very different way of what does it mean to come home, and what are we coming home to? What does the world look like that we're coming home to? And it is also, I mean, to tie it to It's a Wonderful Life, like It is also a movie that when you get to the core of it, or especially the end of it, is like also asking like, what is the meaning of an individual's life and an individual's experience as compared to like global, or thinking about the opening of this movie, like universal scale? Do the dramas of any one individual matter on the grand scale or not? You know, there's all these questions that come up in the trial. This movie definitely takes a turn when it gets to the last 30 minutes. I don't know when you first watched it, how aware you were that it was going to do this, but like, I was not prepared for this to become a debate about all the things that get debated in the trial there, and particularly a debate about empire and a debate about the relationships between Americans and the British and all. Like, it spun from this love story, which is very compelling and very interestingly laid out, to like, oh, there's some bigger issues that we're going to nakedly discuss. I was kind of blown away and excited by that, to say they've got a lot that they want to wrestle with.
And it's so interesting how relevant the issues they talk about are still today.
Oh, yeah.
So the last 30 minutes or so, that's one reason you could pair this film with Defending Your Life, which we watched a while ago. But again, as with The Best Years of Your Lives, there's a contrast. Defending Your Life is about those two people. It's not about anything necessarily larger than those two people. But here is, you know, these two individuals are stand-ins for their respective nations and peoples. The other thing I love about the opening, and it's simply coincidental, because Powell and Pressburger would not have seen It's a Wonderful Life, right? And vice versa. But they both open with that cosmic perspective. But again, It's a Wonderful Life, it's all about, we're going to zero in on George Bailey. But this film zeroes in on the Earth. And right away, and of course, it begins with that supernova, i.e. atomic bomb explosion, which is a nice little political commentary along the way. The film, by the way, started shooting on VJ Day. So
interesting.
Yeah, so the Hiroshima was just a couple of weeks behind them, so they were acutely aware of that.
I don't want to walk through the entire plot of this, but I do kind of want to walk through the first half of this, because I think structurally this movie is really interesting, and that gives us a way to get into it, and then we can talk about the back half kind of all at once. So after that kind of universal scale opening, and it is pretty cool, and they do go back to that one other time when they're at the trial, and they pan out from like the trial. You think it's like, okay, this is this room with these people, and it keeps pulling out. And you just realize the scope and the scale, and all of a sudden that even that trial setting becomes a galaxy in and of itself. And you realize like how big this little question can be. This movie, after all of that, once it starts to zoom in on Earth and zoom in on the kind of the English Channel and the fog, this movie begins with a bang. Like the opening of this movie, of Peter and June having kind of this chance meeting over the radio, right? Peter's in a plane that's going down. He start almost the first thing he expresses is, well, I'm dead. Like there's actually, I'm going to lay out a situation for you where there's no way that I'm going to live. And then they proceed to have this conversation. And it's one of these great, like, Peter gives this great bio dump in like a line, where like, she's like, where is your position? And I wrote this down. He rattles off: position nil, age 27, education interrupted, violently interrupted, politics conservative by nature, labor by experience. It's like, let's get all this stuff out of the way. This is who I am, because they're in a hurry. Like he only has so much time to live. And then they, you know, he quotes poetry and they're having this conversation, and he has sort of accepted death. Like that's the first thing we need to realize, is this is going to be a movie about Peter pushing back against death. But it opens by him basically already saying, well, I might as well be dead right now, because there's no survival of this. And then so in essence, we get the most star-crossed meet cute you can have in a movie. Like it opens with these two people meeting, and it's like, well, other than the fact that I'm watching a movie, there's no way this goes beyond this conversation. So they kind of have there's almost an ease to it, because it's like, well, this, and it allows Peter to be so charming, because he's like, none of this matters now, it's over for me.
And I love the fact that as he's quoting the poetry initially, she's saying, "I cannot read you," right? So it's to me, there's a little bit of a cultural joke going on there as he's coming across as this poetic Brit, and she's the plain spoken American who cannot read him. His choice of poetry is interesting. He begins with Sir Walter Raleigh's. The poem's called "The Passionate Man's Pilgrimage," but it's a poem which is intended to be somebody speaking at the moment of his death. Giving my scallop shell of quiet, my staff of faith to walk upon, my scrip of joy, immortal diet, my bottle of salvation, my gown of glory, hope's true gauge, and thus I'll take my pilgrimage. So that's the one about death. But then he quotes Andrew Marvel's to his coy mistress. But at my back, I always hear time's winged chariot hurrying near. And that poem, of course, is a seduction poem. It's a poem about trying to persuade the coy mistress to go to bed with him because they don't have much time left. So it's really interesting that he should combine both the poem about resignation to death and the poem that says, "Let's jump into bed because you never know when you're going to die," which beautifully encapsulates their situation.
I also love, you know, after he does the Raleigh quote, he says, "I'd rather have written that than flown through Hitler's legs," which also points, I mean, it's actually, when you think about the situation, is a very like heartbreaking statement, that because we learn later that he is an aspiring poet, and it's like, well, my legacy is that I fought in this war. My legacy is not going to be that I wrote something like Raleigh wrote, you know? So we learn that later, but as I watched that the second time, that really clever line sort of stung a little bit, thinking like, he's not going to have a poetic legacy, at least as this movie is setting up. So I also, the other thing I'm struck by in this is the way this, we talked about Technicolor a little bit, the way this looks, particularly the way June is lit. Mm-hmm. So she's in this, presumably a flight tower, right? Trying to bring planes in. But she's lit like she's in a color film noir, though, like she's in this like deep shadow. You only see the bottom of her face at first, so you really focus on her mouth and her lips, which is interesting because that's the only way Peter knows her, is through her voice and through her words. You also get this great like red light flashing behind her. It's just such, that's one of those things where it's like you could just take a still from that and it's like, this is one of the most gorgeous things I've ever seen. And you barely see her. And it, so I think what I like about that in the opening is that I realize I'm in the hands of people who are really interested in what this movie's going to look like, not just what this movie's going to say.
Mm-hmm.
So we get Peter's resignation. You know, he's going to jump. So we get like the most, sort of deeply romantic, heroic setup, right? This like it's, again, the sort of star-crossed lovers thing is great. And then from there, after Peter's leap, we get this cut to black and white. And this is our introduction to the other world, is I think how they refer to it. It's glancingly referred to as heaven, but people always kind of question if it's heaven or what we call this. So it seems like we're in, I think they refer to it as a training center at some point. So I don't know if it's like training people for the afterlife. And it seems like particularly a training center for Allied Air Force men. Like everybody who's coming in is an Allied pilot. So British, American, French. We don't see any Russians in this part. So this is
or Germans.
Right. But the Russians would have been allies in World War II. So there is this sense of like, when we're talking about the Allies, we're really talking about these folks. So you can almost see some Cold War a little bit there, like already starting to, or maybe already starting to crystallize. There's the great joke of the Coke machine that, you know, the Americans come in and the first thing they do is apparently the next world for the Americans has a Coke machine, which is also kind of this commentary on American culture, kind of the low American culture, which we're going to come back to later. We also learn that people are treated as equals there. So they're like your rank kind of goes away. The one American pilot wants officer's quarters. And she says, no, we're all equal here. And then the last thing we see from that check-in process is everybody gets like a big set of kind of plastic shrink wrapped wings, which is a reference to what Peter says when he jumps out. Are we going to have props or wings? Like, have they updated flying in heaven? Which is interesting because the wings never come back. You never see anybody in heaven with wings. So I'm not sure why they're given wings other than if it's just a vestigial symbol of, well, now you're here. But I really love that they look like a commercial product, you know. And the first thing we see of the afterlife is all of these wings sort of stacked up on these racks, you know, as if they've been produced in a war plant like ammunition.
Yeah, Roger Ebert compares it to dry cleaning bags that the wings are in. And we should say that's one of the interesting things about heaven is it's a very modernist perspective of heaven. You have plexiglass is prominent later on in the trial scene, and it's got a little bit of a Fritz Lang Metropolis feel to it in some ways. But also, as we talk about that kind of early procession of airmen, we have to point out that a very young Richard Attenborough,
yes,
possibly his first role, I didn't check on that, but certainly close to his first role, not his actual first role. He kind of gets the field of dreams line that Ray Liotta has, right? Mm-hmm. Is this heaven? It says, you know, is this heaven? And of course, the film for its American release was retitled as Stairway to Heaven, because the thought was Americans didn't want to hear about death necessarily. So which is interesting because it kind of forecloses what, as you were saying earlier, Sam, is not necessarily explicitly said. You know, Attenborough says that is this heaven, but we're never told explicitly that it's heaven. It's some, and of course you have some place beyond, and of course you have the epigraph at the beginning of the film saying that it's another world, which exists only in the mind of a young airman. We'll come back to that, obviously. So whether or not it's heaven, it's kind of left for you to read into it, I think, what you want it to be.
Well, and here's where we get another kind of I guess it wouldn't be an echo of, but a precursor to defending your life, because we also learn that heaven or that the next world is heavily bureaucratic. There's a lot of rules and accounting, and they keep records, right? There's records of everyone's life. So we get that great shot of them looking down, you know, through the big circular hole on the basically where the records are stored for the living. And it looks like this big computer circuit, which I don't know that mm-hmm. they would have even had a sense of what that looks like, but like, it's kind of interesting that to 2024 eyes, it just looks like they're looking down at a big computer, like innards of a big computer. So maybe heaven, they talk about it being a clock. Maybe it's a computer and a clock. I mean, cause that's what our clocks would be now. So it's I think that's really interesting. The other thing that the woman who seems in charge of that office, I don't know that she's ever given a title, says is everyone here is allowed to start how they like.
Mm.
And I wasn't sure what to make of that. I mean, I don't know that we need to dwell on that line, but it sounded because that's in that early scene where we're trying to figure out what this is. And I don't even exactly, it's kind of unclear what she's even referencing, because she says it almost like an answer to a question that wasn't exactly asked. Mm. But do you have thoughts on that line?
Well, I guess I guess it gets back to that kind of egalitarianism that we see there. So it's the idea that everybody is on the same level, but at the same time, everybody has, in a sense, there's a kind of individualism. Just because everybody's on the same level doesn't mean that everybody's kind of loses their identity. Mm-hmm. That's what it felt like to me.
So then from here, we get the return to color, and we get Peter now washing up on the beach. We realize he's alive because his gunner Bob was waiting for him, right? And this causes this accounting alarm to go off that somebody's missing. And that's where we go down to see Peter on the beach. So we know he's alive, but what I love is that Peter doesn't. That Peter thinks like, okay, I have now reached the afterlife, and apparently the afterlife starts on a beach. So, you know, he's in his flight suit and stuff, and he walks and he's stripping things away. And in my head, I'm thinking, you don't know where you are. You should keep all of your equipment. But he's like, well, no, I'm clearly in the afterlife. So he leaves all that behind and he goes on this walk. And he encounters the keep out sign, which is interesting to, you know, like, again, I'm trying to get into his head of like, oh, there are places here we're not allowed to go. Like, he doesn't say anything, but you can, the movie does a good job of helping you, like, I don't know. I felt like I knew everything he was thinking when he looked at that keep out sign. Like, oh, I mean, I have now started to encounter the mysteries of heaven because there are parts that I cannot go to. And then we have this great strange moment where, well, he sees a dog and he's like, oh, I always hoped there would be dogs here. And then he sees this naked boy sitting on the beach playing a recorder with a bunch of goats, which seems like a, you know, like an Arcadia, you know, kind of scene. And it's so strange. And then a big bomber flies over and he realizes, oh, I'm just in England. And so, you know, which is, you know, for the English audience, it's a very like, seaside pastoral view of England that's then interrupted by this bomber. Then he runs, he sees a woman on a bike, it's June, and he runs to find her. And it's kind of funny because we have this moment where they meet and they embrace and they kiss, and this feels like the end of a movie. It's like, oh, it all worked out, even though you check your clock and you're like, we're 20 minutes in and we've already seen what's going to happen, or the other plot machinations in progress, but they do shoot it like it's the end of the movie. I kind of loved that feeling, like we could just stop right now and the miracle happened, the two impossible, they're never going to meet and they're together, and I loved that moment before everything else happens.
I'm not sure what angle he cut to catch up with her, but I think he must be a very swift runner. Yeah, the moment with the naked boy, it's almost like you want in the Navy to think, well, you know, maybe I'm in the Greek version of the afterlife. When the film used to show on TV in the early '60s and '70s, that was a scene they would cut out. That was always censored, which is really kind of odd. There's nothing revealing about it. It's just kind of an odd moment. So.
So then from their kiss, we cut back to the other world where we see that they're dealing with the fault, with the accounting fault. We actually see like a printout of like, here's how many invoiced, here's how many appeared, and that they're missing one. And here's where we get introduced to my favorite character in the movie, who is Conductor 71, who is a 18th century French aristocrat who was killed during the French Revolution, the glorious French Revolution, as he says. And we see that apparently he has a job, and his job is that he's assigned people to basically collect and conduct to the next life. And because of the thick English fog, he missed Peter as he was falling out of the plane. And what I love about him is like in films, we see other, you know, images of death. I mean, he is not a Grim Reaper. He's the most benign version of the Grim Reaper or Death from the Seventh Seal, right? He's sort of a fun, silly man, to a certain degree. And what I like about him as a character is that he is set up to be at odds with what we know to be our central couple. I mean, his job is to bring Peter to the next world, which would, upset this romantic pairing that we have. But he's not malicious about it, and he follows the rules. And as the movie goes on, he seems like he doesn't really care how this thing works out. And by the end, he's even helping Reeves as he's making his case, you know, that he's just he seems almost like a free agent rather than a bureaucrat. He's part of a bureaucracy, but he's not particularly, he doesn't particularly care about the outcome so long as his life stays okay. And I love that about him.
Well, I mean, you know, again, we have to pair this with It's a Wonderful Life and compare him to Clarence, who's also a really quite wonderful character in that film. The other thing I think, the other film, there's a couple more films I would pair this with on this theme of the personification of death. 1943, I think it was. There's a film called Here Comes Mr. Jordan, which is about a man who is not supposed to die, and who is taken up too soon, and then he has to be sent back to. They have to send him back to Earth so he can finish out his life. And that was remade as Heaven Can Wait with Warren Beatty in 1978. So it's kind of interesting. Those films kind of take the opposite premise. What happens if somebody is taken too soon, as opposed to somebody who wasn't taken when he was supposed to be taken?
So then from here we get him sent down to this world, and this is the first time I think we get the actual transition from black and white to color, which apparently was really complicated to do with Technicolor. I mean, everything you read about this movie, they take pains to say this was all the stuff they had to do to make this effect work. So it's the first time we see this transition, and you're instantly thinking about Dorothy and Oz, right? Like that was 7 years before this, that this is also a movie thinking about two worlds, and one in color, one in black and white. But in this field, it's an inversion, right? Because it's this life that is Technicolor, instead of the dream life or the other world, in Technicolor. And I think that's interesting because it shows that even formally, even before you know how the rest of this movie is going to go, formally, this movie is life affirming. In that it is saying this life that we live in, the life that has wars and all this stuff, like this is still, to borrow a phrase from Capra, this is still the wonderful life, right? Like this is still a very alive place. And it's not that the place we go to next is the thing we're necessarily aspiring to, but this movie wraps its arms around this life quite a bit, and does it not only with what happens in the movie, but with the formal elements of the movie to put this life in color.
Yeah, and I think from a very practical kind of literal point of view, Sam, it has to be in color because that's life. Mm-hmm. I mean, we live life in color, and so you know, so in a sense that they really had no choice, because to present this world in black and white and black and white in order that the other world can be in color would actually be more alienating. And so you know, so we say the other world is black and white. It's actually more kind of monochrome, and I think you can. To me, that means you can project whatever you want into that. Or it's saying that, you know, whatever it looks like, our imagination is not fully adequate to present it. So we're just going to leave it kind of monochrome, and then you can kind of fill in whatever you want.
So one pushback to that beautiful statement is one of the great lines of the movie, which is when 71 comes into this world, he says, one is starved for Technicolor up there. So there is this sense, I mean, the movie is telling you that there is something to the life of this world that is different than that. I mean, it's a great line. And apparently when that the actual line is, one is starved for color up there, and then they redubbed in Technicolor, which is just also a little piece of branding right in the text of the movie.
That is a wonderful point, Sam. I do want to follow up on that, what you said earlier about the film being life affirming. You're right, because I mean first of all, it's a wonderfully self-referential line, obviously, but that line is saying that life does make a difference to live a life, even if there is an afterlife, even if there is, you know, some place you go and you are reunited with your friends or family, even if that's true. It doesn't cancel out the years that you have on Earth. And so I think that's really a good point that you made about it's life affirming, because especially the opportunity to experience love, which is one of the key things of this film. And love is what you experience here on Earth. And, you know, at the end, we hear the line from Sir Walter Scott, right? Love is heaven, heaven is love. And so I think the color contributes to that sense that even if the afterlife exists, and even if you have this, you know, eternal persistence, it doesn't take away from the uniqueness and the intensity and the value of actual life itself.
Well, I think especially in the political context of this film, too, that we are coming off of a decade and a half of global depression and war. And there, I mean, they even use the language, Reeves used the language in the trial about rebuilding this world today and rebuilding this world tomorrow. So there is this sense of like this world is, or this life is worth living. And we need to embrace that. So I think that that's really built into this. The other thing we get during this conversation is the first introduction about the dispute over whether Peter's time is, borrowed time or extra allotted time, which comes up at the trial, because that matters. It's like whose mistake is this, and does that matter? Does it matter? Like, because 71 points out, it's like, you lost nothing. You were supposed to die. So anything you got beyond this, right, is like, you're not entitled to, because you weren't entitled to it to begin with. But then Peter brings up, it's like, but this happened, so now we have to reimagine this because this happened. So this, you know, question of like, you know, Peter should have died but lived. Another movie I thought about, which is very different than this, is one of the first movies we watched. I thought about Fearless a little bit too. Another, you know, another plane accident or plane crash. And it's like, okay, what happens if you live when you're not supposed to have lived? How does that then make you rethink living in life? So here's where we get Peter asking for an appeal. We learn that June will live until she's 97. So we know she has a long life ahead of her. I did a little math. June would have died around the year 2020. So maybe a casualty of COVID. I don't know. But like she would have lived deep, deep into the 21st century. This also points to this question that comes up a lot in film, which is interested in thinking about life and its meanings, which is the you know, we always talk about choice versus fate and determinism. Like it's interesting because Peter is able to make this appeal. But at the same time, it does seem like a world where there is some degree of determinism, because there are times when you are supposed to have died, right? Your number is up, and your number can be up early like Peter's or very late like June's. This movie isn't heavy-handed with that, but it definitely is raising that question about the world.
No, that's a really interesting point. But then it makes you wonder, well, what about Dr. Reeves? I mean, we know that he kind of intentionally, you know, sacrifices himself so he doesn't hit the ambulance. So was that his choice, or was that because his number was up? And we don't know. But you're right. It certainly plays with that tension.
And there is this, there's this great moment when in that first scene in the next world where Bob is talking to the woman, the administrative woman who, and, you know, she says, well, there hasn't been a mistake made for 1,000 years. So he says, so there have been mistakes. So it's like, yes, this is this perfect system where things are determined, but there's also an open, like it also is possible to have that break open too. So like this movie is sort of kind of putting both out there to say, yes, these things are determined, but they're not wholly determined, because maybe you can make an appeal. Maybe love can overcome this. Maybe mistakes can be made and changes can, you know, need to happen, you know, in these things. So I think it does sort of both of those. So from here, we get the introduction of Dr. Reeves. We get him with the camera obscura, which is interesting, because at one level it's like, oh, this is an unnecessary moment in the movie. But it's also, I think it's also really interesting, because maybe it tells us some stuff about him. I have some thoughts on this. I'm curious, what are your thoughts on introducing Reeves using the camera obscura to look down on his village?
Well, first of all, just kind of an extra textual comment that this was based to a certain extent on an actual experience of Michael Powell's, of knowing somebody in a village that had a camera obscura like this. And so, well, I think, you know, one of the subtexts in this film are some, you know, kind of Shakespearean allusions or Shakespearean references, and it's very explicit later on with Midsummer Night's Dream. But I think Reeves is almost a Prospero-like character, and it's almost like he's kind of the human version of the godlike figure, and so his camera obscura perspective looks a lot like that view from heaven when they look down on the, you know, on the record, on all the records. So I think it just suggests that he of course is a key element in the plot because of his investigation into what Peter's physiological condition might be. So I think it just helps create him as this kind of benign. He's powerful, but not in a threatening way. Figure who kind of has a great amount of insight into the world around him. He's kind of keeping a watchful eye out.
Yeah, I thought it showed him as a character who clearly has a different perspective, because his perspective is not just his perspective as an individual, but we see him seeing things from literally a God's eye view of the town, which is also reminds me of the way the movie opens, as we have this universal view. And we look down and we see the English, like there's just sort of looking down and we see him having that same type of view. So, and it's going to be that type of perspective, a person with that type of perspective, that's going to be necessary to be Peter's counsel in the next life.
And it's in black and white, isn't it?
That's in color.
Like, is the, was the I camera, think,
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's another link to heaven with him.
I also, what I like about the Reeves character as well is we're introduced to him as this, you know, neuroscientist doctor. But when he encounters Peter and Peter talks about his experiences, he doesn't dismiss them or doubt their reality.
Right.
At the same time, he has a scientific explanation for them, but he's sort of saying like, well, this is Peter's lived experience and that lived experience matters. So we need to treat that as real, even though I think it may also be this, it may also be this scientific explanation that is creating his subjective experience of this. I love that this is not a movie about Peter needing to like argue that he's not insane, that the first medical person he encounters is like, oh yes, tell me more, I think I understand what's going on. And he treats Peter with a kind of dignity there, where there could be in another version of this, it could be about Peter trying to get people to understand this thing that he's experiencing and they can't see. He's not surrounded by people like that, and I really like that take in this movie.
Well, you know, Peter's symptoms are actually classic indicators of epilepsy. And there was still so much kind of stigma attached to epilepsy that they couldn't be explicit about that. But there was a lot of research behind this. Powell's brother-in-law was actually a plastic surgeon. And Pressburger had read a book by a fellow Hungarian called Journey Round My Skull, which was about his own experiences of something similar to what Peter was going through. So they were very careful to actually kind of ground the film in the current neuroscience of the day. Evidently, there's even a very small touch in the in Dr. Reeves's house. There's a couple of depictions of brains on the wall. And evidently, those are medically quite accurate. So I really love that about this film, in that it doesn't say it's not an either or film. It's a both and film about what's physiological and what's psychological, what's imagined and what's real.
So this leads to the question that I wanted to ask about this. When you watch this movie, do you find yourself concerned with the question of, is this real or part of Peter's mental or neurological condition? I mean, is that question something that feels like it's at the center of the movie for you? Do you care? Do you think the movie cares?
I think the movie cares, but I think the movie is giving you ambiguous information. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you could go back to the epigraph and you could say, well, that kind of says it, because it says that the two worlds, one of them exists only in the mind of young airman, whose life and imagination have been violently shaped by war. So you could say, well, that seems to be saying, yeah, this is his imagination. And then you have the fact that the judge is the surgeon. And so it's kind of a Wizard of Oz moment, right? But then you have other things, like you have scenes in heaven where Peter is not present, including the first scene in heaven. And then, of course, you have the mystery of the chess book, mm-hmm. the chess book disappearing and then reappearing. So I think the movie works a little bit against its own epigraph and to say, well, I'm not sure it's quite that simple. And then, of course, you have the other question of, well, it's the classic kind of mind-brain issue. I mean, if there was another world, or if there is another world, and how would it manifest itself to us? Maybe it manifests itself to us in some of Peter's symptoms. So I think, to me, one of the miracles of the film is that I don't have trouble with that tension. I enjoy the tension in the same way that I think what happens is I think I end up following Dr. Reeves. Mm-hmm. And when Dr. Reeves says it's vitally important that he win his case, you can take that from a physiological point of view. You could take it from a spiritual point of view, but maybe both of those are true. That's what I think it works really well.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think the movie wants to say this is an interesting question. We're going to show you things that are pointing in all kinds of directions, and we're not going to hit you with a hammer at the end to say this or to tell you this way or that way. I will say the first time I watched it, I didn't think about that. I mean, I didn't think much about that at all. And then I read everything I read about it seemed obsessed with that question. Oh. And then I watched it a second time and I'm like, yeah, it really is central in the movie. that you think about it, but not that you answer it. And that, I think that definitely seemed to be the case. So I can't talk with you about this movie and not just hand you the ball and clear out for a second. So this movie, as you've already pointed to, makes some clear Shakespearean references. I mean, we get people debating how to spell Shakespeare's name. we get a bunch of Americans trying to put on A Midsummer Night's Dream. We actually see them rehearsing and acting this out. So I kind of wanted to ask you, what does Midsummer Night's Dream have to do with this movie? Because that seems like a very intentional thing to drop in there.
Yeah, you know, so Midsummer Night's Dream is about these characters that have this, you know, weird experience. They encounter this world full of fairies that operate on them in various kinds of ways. And when they awake at the end, right, they want to kind of dismiss what's happened to them as a dream. But then there are these remnants of evidence that maybe what happened is actually real. And so I think the film is kind of playing with that sort of tension that the ambiguity that the movie has. I mean, when I used to teach Midsummer Night's Dream to students, I used to say, well, you know, who or what are the fairies? And one explanation for the fairies is the fairies are hormones. I mean, the fairies kind of embody those various drives that create that motivate human beings, and so you could kind of demystify them by saying they stand for this. And I think this film is doing the same thing. You could say, well, these are just images that are going on in Peter's brain, or at the same time, you can say, no, this is exactly how the other world kind of presents itself. So I think so. Midsummer's Dream is about that kind of connection between the world of magic and the world of reality. I also think, as I said earlier, there's the other connection of Midsummer Night's Dream is when Titania, the fairy queen, has been put under a spell. The spell is removed at the end with a little dewdrop that comes from a magic flower. Mm. In the same way that June's tear is a symbol of her love for Peter. And then back to the kind of the Tempest connection, not only Reeves as Prospero, but Conductor 71, a little bit as Ariel, a spirit kind of moving between the two worlds. So I think there's, you know, those elements are in there.
All right. So I want to move to talking about the trial, because that's the last, it's kind of the third act of this movie. But before we get to that, I just want to at least tip my hat to the fact that this film has so many, we haven't really talked about visual effects in this movie.
Right.
But it's amazing. I was not ready for how much they were going to do with this. So I'm just going to list off a couple, talk about any that you find particularly interesting. So we've already talked about the black and white to Technicolor transition. We get the freezing of time. The sort of frozen ping pong shot particularly is pretty great. We see characters walk through doors. I think they're like, mm-hmm. basically drawn out or kind of rotoscoped out. I don't know what the specific name for that technology would be. We get the stairway to the other world, which is the great effect of this movie. I mean, it's both an effect in terms of like a piece of set design, but then also all the things that they do around it and all the visual tricks they do to make these massive statues on the escalator. There is a ton of really interesting matte painting used in this movie, particularly for the trial scene, to build out the scope and scale of that. I want to point to one shot that I think looks spectacular, which is the first time we see Reeves on the motorcycle. Mm-hmm. It's very kinetic. It's close up on him and he's driving. I think that's an actual shot, right? I don't think that it doesn't look like a rear projection thing. I don't know how they got the camera where they needed to do that. It looks spectacular though. And then I didn't realize the first time I watched it, I thought, well, that's really strange that they use this like hyper energetic shot to show him racing around on the motorcycle. And then you realize later on, oh, this is a setup to talk about how he dies. So they can wrap that death up really quickly because they do the earlier thing. But that's one of my favorite shots of the movie because I just didn't quite know how they did it. Do you have any particular effect that jumps out to you?
Okay. This is a little bit of a criticism or a carping, I suppose. I don't know if you notice that the the difference between the freeze frame of the ping pong match and the positions the players are actually in when Peter goes to investigate.
Yes.
Because they didn't have the technology for him to actually walk around a freeze frame. And then you can see in when they freeze June outside the operating room, she does her very, very best. But, you know, there's a couple of times. And, of course, one overlooks those things.
Yeah, and when they do, there's a couple shots of the staircase from far away that you can just tell the layering. But what I love about it is not necessarily always the execution, but the ambition to be like, oh, yeah, we're going to do all of this stuff.
I like, and I do like the one you alluded to earlier, Sam, when you pan out from the courtroom and it's a spiral nebula. That's remarkable. And even just the shots of space at the beginning, when you think of this as 1946, there's a wonderful, I have to get this in before we have to stop. There's a wonderful commentary on the Criterion Channel by Thelma Schoonmaker, Martin Scorsese's longtime editor, who ended up marrying Michael Powell. And she didn't even know who he was until she started working on Raging Bull. And she has a very interesting conversation about how difficult it was to mix black and white and color in Raging Bull. And that's why she really appreciates what's going on here. She talks about, this is really interesting to me. She talks about the simplicity of the crash scene, mm-hmm. how very few elements they needed. You know, you have a hubcap rolling, you've got a little bit of fire. She says, you know, if we were to do this today, it would be this expensive, you know, millions of dollars for some kind of fancy CGI. And so she in a sense kind of worries that more recent technology actually in some ways detracts from the craft of filmmaking, film editing. The other thing she said, which I could not get over, is they did basically one take, maybe two. And you think about what digital enables us to do, right? Take after take after take after take. And you wonder if maybe you're losing, maybe that's not necessary, but because the technology allows you to do it, you do it. The final thing I'll point out is they had to wait for the Technicolor camera to begin shooting, because Sir Laurence Olivier was using it to shoot Henry V in Ireland at the time.
So I will just say that Criterion has tons of great features on this. So I got a chance to watch all of them, and they were all really interesting and really great. So we get to the trial. We have the sort of debate about choosing a counsel, like, and it's kind of this question of do you choose a what famous great mind do you choose, or do you choose a common person? We see that the jury is full of common people. I also find it interesting that the only other like famous person we encounter is John Bunyan, who is also a conductor. Yeah. So it's like, huh? So he in the afterlife, he has a job, and he apparently is a conductor, like Conductor 71 is. We realize that the prosecuting counsel is Abraham Farlon, who is both a common man, but in the world of this movie, this person of note, the first person to die at Lexington and Concord. I was wondering, like, is that a real thing? Abraham Farlon is not a real person. Okay. From what I could tell, I was like, okay. I thought, huh, I've never heard of him before. He is at least when you search for Abraham Farlon, all you get is stuff about this movie. So he does not seem to be a historical figure.
Well, it's also interesting that it's, you know, you can't help but think that it's Raymond Massey, yes, who, of course, has played Abraham Lincoln and is in a character named Abraham. So I think, yes, even though he didn't pick Lincoln as his defender, he sort of got him.
Yes, yes. We get this. We get the trial venue, which is almost like a Greek theater, is what it feels like. And then you get shots. At first, you think, okay, well, yes, there's a gallery here, and then you keep getting shots to realize how big that is. And I wonder how this must have played in 1946, because almost everybody we see in that gallery a lot of who we see are soldiers.
Yes.
And so this is also an image about all the people we have lost in the last 4 or 5 years to this war. You know, like, there's no commentary on it, but I kept thinking, like, wow, in 1946, if you lost a spouse or a child, would you think about, like, yep, that's them there. Like, they're all part of this in this world, too. I wonder just how that plays in 1946, mm-hmm. If it's more poignant. It's also a very segregated view of the afterlife. I mean, everybody, yeah, is sitting by their culture, their race, their gender, their time period. Mm-hmm. And the trial's going to undercut that and think about, like, you know, are these differences real? Things like that. So there's lots of issues debated in the trial. Do you have a particular take on, just, I'm just looking at the clock here. Do you have a particular take on the trial that you want to dig into? I mean, there's lots of themes that get raised here.
Yeah, there's lots. I guess the one I would want to mention, Sam, is, as I said at the beginning, the film is still very politically relevant. And it's the obvious point when the various jurors are replaced with all Americans. And to me, it's such a, it's still such a relevant issue about understanding America as an immigrant country. And it's interesting to me because, shifting away from this idea of, and of course, this is the big debate between that's being navigated here. Why should America and Britain have this close relationship? And the first lineup of jurors is a kind of indictment of Britain as a colonial power. And there was still a feeling on the part of Americans that there was this colonial power that had seen better days. And then that gets shifted over to the identity of America as an immigrant community. And I just think it's interesting because this effort to show how different they are also kind of ends up showing in some ways how similar they are. So the notion of being a colonial power, if you turn it on its head, you're now an immigrant country. And so it's an interesting way to kind of work out a reconciliation between the two.
There's also, I think, the flip side of that is that if this is an indictment of British Empire, it's also a warning to the Americans about American Empire,
that's
too.
Right.
I mean,
that's
as
right.
We're moving into the second half of the American century, like there is this sense of like, okay, yes, this is true about us, but, so it's interesting thing about this being an English movie that's really wants to, really does want to kind of indict the British Empire, but at the same time wants to say, but America, let's not forget. Also, you could look at every one of those immigrants, and if you know your American history, it's like these are all people groups who are marginalized either currently or in the American past, so you see Irish, Russian, Chinese, African American, like these are not people who are necessarily always given historically or contemporaneously a seat at the table, in the American project. So there is, if you know your history, there's a kind of indictment there as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I think another interest. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Powell was a he loved Americans. And in fact, part of his research for the film is he was in a he actually hung out with some American GIs in one of their transport ships. So the Thelma Schoonmaker tells this wonderful story about she and Powell got into a taxi in England, and the taxi driver was complaining about Americans and says they're so damn enthusiastic. And Powell said, yes, that's why I like them. So he has a very natural affinity for Americans.
I think the other big theme, if we're kind of compressing this in, is this question of justice versus law.
Yes. You know,
there's this great exchange where Reeves says, I'm pleading for the right of the individual against the system. Farland says, but it's also against the law, the eternal law of the universe. Nothing is stronger than the law. The whole universe is built upon it. And Reeves says, this is a court of justice, not a court of law.
Yeah.
So that's like a really, to me, that's a really interesting thing. And then you get a corollary debate, which is sort of love versus law. Law may guide the universe, but love rules things here on earth. And there is this question of, can love overcome the strictures of systems and things like this, and this is the line I had referenced earlier when he's showing the tier. He says, here in this tier are love and truth and friendship. These qualities alone can build a new world today and must build a better tomorrow. And so there is, again, this 1946 question of like, how are we going to rebuild the world after the destruction of the Second World War? And, they're making this case about love on this broad scale, but then also on this individual scale.
Well, that leads me to a question for you, Sam. Mm-hmm. In many of our past podcasts, you've often struggled with being able to believe in the reality of the love that some of these couples have for each other. So I'm just curious. It's interesting to me. It seems like you've had no trouble with the premise of this film, that this exchange between these two over the radio, that's true love. I thought you were going to kick against that.
I'm a hopeless romantic, though, and that I buy the, it's not even love at first sight because they don't see each other. That's why that opening matters so much. Is like, you watch those two people fall in love over the radio. And that's the case the movie has to make.
Yeah.
And it has to make it at the end. It has to make that this is real love. And it's in part because it is only that. And it is this sense of like, we have to skip past all of the other pleasantries because I'm going to die in a minute. And like, I buy it. I buy it 100%. I think this, so to me, it's an indictment of movies where they don't do it well. It's like this one, I never questioned it.
Of course, it's an allegory, so they have to fall in love.
Right, but they execute it as the thing. Yeah. So then we get to the end, and the question is, will she sacrifice herself for Peter? Will she get on the escalator? And she does, and they win. Anything else you want to talk about with this movie?
Oh, I just wanted to say, we alluded to this, but I wanted to come back to it for a minute, and that is, it's a subtext in the film, but chess as a kind of a metaphor for the relationship between heaven and earth, and another anticipation of the seventh seal, obviously, with the chess match. So, and it just leads to some wonderful moments of Francophilia by Conductor 71, who, I mean, what you said earlier, Sam, is right on. Even though they're in heaven or wherever this is, they still maintain their historical and national allegiances. So he's still a French dandy through and through. So.
Yes, I love the way he's dressed at the trial, too. Oh, he has his finest on. And last thing I will say is that we talked about this as like making this political statement. This is a movie born out of propaganda. I mean, this is a propaganda film that Jack Beddington, from the Ministry of Information, asked Pressburger and Powell to make a movie about how do we bring Americans and British together after the end of the Second World War. So this is maybe the best propaganda film because it's not a propaganda film, but it is. I think it raises all those questions, but does it in a way that doesn't feel like you're getting hit over the head with it as a piece of propaganda.
Okay, two more quick things. One of the critics I read, Peter Bradshaw on The Guardian, actually made a connection to Star Wars. At the beginning of the film, he says the starlit expanse, the distant detonation, the intertitles. Anyway, and then the other thing is Powell and Pressburger called the film a stratospheric joke, which wasn't intended to belittle it, but just to kind of get at the tone of the film.
So what do you have for us for next week, Barrett?
Okay, I'm sorry, Sam. Now I'm on to Powell and Pressburger. And we've already talked a little bit about Technicolor, but I want to watch the film they made the next year, Black Narcissus, which some people think is one of the most beautiful Technicolor films ever made. And there are special effects in that film that are just really worth talking about. So that's what we're going to do, another Powell and Pressburger.
I am 100%. And one of the questions I didn't get to was, if I watched another movie, what should I watch next? Well, you just answered that
there
question.
There you go. I've answered your question.
Barrett, thank you so much for recommending this film, for having this conversation. This is such a great, charming film. It speaks so well to those 1946 films. So thank you for recommending this and having this conversation. That is all the time that we have, but we will be back next week to talk about Black Narcissus in the video store.